Good morning, Fairbanks. We're on the air with Problem Corner. I'm your guest host this morning, filling in for David Pruse. This is Jennifer Uhas. And our first guest this morning is Rebecca Logan. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
Rebecca is the CEO of The Alliance. Some of you know that as the support industry. And their tagline is linking Alaska's resources to Alaska's people. And Rebecca is here to talk about the pending gas line today.
A small, unimportant topic for the state of Alaska to start with.
It is a very important.
It is. You know, it really is. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to people in Fairbanks today and have a discussion with you. You know, we're facing some pretty critical legislation right now as we wind down the session on the AK LNG project.
And there's multiple versions of this legislation happening right now.
There are, yep. There's the bill the governor introduced, and that was in the Senate side, SB 280, and then the Senate Resources Committee introduced SB 275. And on the House side, the House has the governor's bill, HB 381. And so each of those committees has made changes to the bill, and those are working through the process.
And which version is preferable to the industry at this point?
You know, I can tell you that the industry is not going to support what's happening in the Senate Resources Committee. That bill fails to recognize just a fundamental principle that this project only happens if economics work. They took the governor's bill, they dumped their bill onto that, and they've loaded that thing up with so many taxes and pitfalls that there's just no way that any project could progress under that kind of a burden.
Well, and I don't want to be too simplistic, but us lay people out here talk about issues in ways that we can relate to. And I started saying to a few people that while, of course, you know, Alaska wants its fair share, we are a resource state. You know, we've been debating what is fair and how does that look? Is that a property tax? Is that something that's volumetric, meaning the volume of what's coming through once something's finally built, which in some ways makes sense that something doesn't increase in value until it's actually doing something. You know, a vacant lot is worth a lot less than a thriving business. But I've likened it to us average people trying to buy a house, that we really don't sign on the dotted line. And if the interest rate seems like it's bouncing around and we're not sure what the escrow is and we're not sure what else is coming into play, is that a fair assessment?
I think so. I mean, that's all about uncertainty, right? And you're right. None of us manage our purchases, our major purchases, in that kind of uncertainty. And, you know, these huge LNG projects, the first, you know, 5 to 10 years, usually 10 years of that, are the most critical ones when they aren't, when there is no production and they're just, you know, they're getting the project built and ramping up. And, that's a typical structure there. In fact, every project in the Gulf, the LNG project in the Gulf, has a ramp-up period of 10 years with no taxes. And the Senate Resources Committee took that out immediately and immediately put a tax burden on a project before they even turn one shovel to get it going.
Well, you mentioned Gulfs, and there's a lot of Gulfs out there, and one has made the news quite a lot lately, knowing that the entire nation is looking at this gas line as something that's part of the Energy First agenda coming from the federal administration, and this president who's investing a lot in Alaska is more heightened, of more importance now that we have some of our national things going on, like a war.
Yep.
And do you think that the recent executive order has anything to do with what's happening in our Senate? I wouldn't say that it's any sort of a threat, but is there a signal from the White House and from D.C. that we really need to get this together, or other things? You know, if this is federalized, what would be the revenue to Alaska? Could we miss out on all of it?
Well, there's a lot packed into that, but definitely the president and his people have indicated that Alaska LNG is a huge priority. In fact, the Secretary of Energy, Chris Wright, just said a couple days ago that it's his number one priority, his number one infrastructure priority. And so with the president invoking the Defense Production Act, you know, that opens all kinds of doors. You know, he has just a series of executive memorandums that allow him to shore up our national security by boosting our domestic energy, and he's looking at coal and petroleum production and the expansion of natural gas and LNG capacity. And so you can tell that, I mean, we aren't the only ones he's thinking of, but it is prominent in their minds and in all of the actions they're taking. And I'm sure they are aware of what's happening here, that here we have this significant asset that's a generational change, not just for Alaska, but for the nation, and that our legislature has a potential to goof that up.
Well, and, you know, looking at the nation, looking at us, seeing, you know, that all politics is local, and those of us talking right here in Fairbanks, because our program is broadcasting in Fairbanks, you know, we talk about the spur line and the things that we need. We talk about the revenue to municipalities, but I've got a hot sheet here from Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation that talks about what would still be coming to our municipalities and to our school districts with regards to state gas royalties. Mm-hmm. But if this is federalized, we lose out on all of this, don't we?
It seems like we'd lose out on a lot of it for sure. If there was actually that kind of a move to take over the project, we definitely wouldn't. There certainly wouldn't be any independent negotiations with individual communities about what they needed, right?
It certainly would diminish what we're receiving. You know, we've been talking right. For so many years that this has been our state's highest priority, and we're finally on the precipice, but you know, the priority for local residents just to have affordable energy
right.
At the expense of not building it. You know, what's going on with the new bill that was heard yesterday in the House and is up for hearing again?
Well, the House bill is House Bill 381. They've actually done a much better job with that than with the Senate. You know, we're still learning a lot about it. In fact, there's a hearing this afternoon where we'll learn more. But they did a good job of tempering things, and not like they didn't immediately get rid of the ramp up. They put in a 6-year ramp up instead of a 10-year ramp up. So they're definitely recognizing that this project doesn't move forward if it's not economic. And they put some interesting things in there. You know, like these community benefit agreements. For communities within 50 miles of the plants or the corridor, which is kind of a unique thing. It's something that, you know, we haven't really seen before, and so we're learning a lot about that. And, of course, there's a project, they're asking for a project labor agreement and the Fairbanks spur within 2 years after the first 750 miles of the main line is built. So there are a lot of little different things in there, but theirs is much more toned down on the heavy tax burden and recognizing that this has to pencil out economically or it doesn't happen.
Back to that same analogy, you know, if it's going to be too expensive, we're just not going to buy the house that we really want. Mm-hmm. We've been waiting too long for this project in Alaska. I remember Ramona Barnes, a lot of people know who she was.
Oh,
you know,
my gosh, yes.
First woman speaker of the House, was also my representative when I lived in Anchorage, and you know, I really got to know her. She really, if you ever had the chance to visit with Ramona, she really was just kind of like a lonely old grandma and would keep opening another grapefruit soda so that you wouldn't leave, so that you could sit and chat. And I remember when Ramona passed, I had said to some of the folks working in the industry, you know, she really just wanted to see the gas line developed. And a few folks laughed at me because I was a brand new legislative aide, new to this, but that was 2003. And she had been waiting for so long.
Now, this is another
23 years later, you know, my own personal experience. Everyone has their own personal experience, right, of how long you've been waiting for this. We don't want to mess this up. We don't want to we want to get everything that we can for Alaska because this is our resource, but we don't want to have another failure where we're waiting another 23 years for someone to bite on this.
Absolutely not.
So what is your recommendation for what people can do who are concerned? A lot of folks out in the community are simply saying, build the line. We know that we're having engaged community discussions at the local level on what will we do for housing, what will we do for schools, and those need to continue. But first, we have to have a line to be thinking about these things.
Right. I think right now is a good time for people to be emailing their senators and their House representatives. My suggestion is that people remind them about the positive aspects of this project, because you often hear, especially in Senate resources, all they talk about is potential horrible things that could happen and all the negative things. And you never hear them talk about the things that we really need. And one of them is energy relief for Alaskans. Fairbanks knows that better than most other communities. The president of NSTAR, John Sims, has said that this is the only project that will lower energy costs in Alaska. That should be at the top of everybody's minds, but I think that gets lost. So I would suggest that people communicate with their legislators and remind them how much of a priority that is, and to make sure that they're doing the things to ensure that we make this a competitive environment for such a large project to be built.
I wonder if they just think that we've talked about that for so many years that it's obvious, but if they're not having that discussion in Senate Resources, then it really isn't part of the discussion. And those of us here in Fairbanks know this was one of our harshest winters. You know, I was here for 1986 or in 7 and 8 when we dipped down to 65 below, but we had 2 straight months of 40 below. And I know that there's people listening that had the same experiences that I did with having to refill your oil tank because it didn't last as long as you thought it did after you filled up in September. It was gone by January, and there was a rush on everyone trying to get their tanks filled. We were going to the gas stations to get the diesel in 5-gallon jerry rigs to put into our holding tanks while we waited for a fill-up because sourdough fuel couldn't get to everyone.
That's quite a story. Like you said, you know, a lot of people have that story, yes. And so, again, making sure people understand that and don't forget that.
It was Southeast on Hydro and Anchorage having lower costs associated than we do in Fairbanks. Right. I hope that there's a lot of people listening who will weigh in with all of our local officials, right? I mean, we've got the Senate, we've got the House, and we have three mayors, you know, Fairbanks, the borough, and North Pole that can be having more thoughtful discussions about what this means for our community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Rebecca, we're going to go to a quick break, and we will be back with more on the Gas Line.
Sounds great.
Good morning, Fairbanks. We're back on Problem Corner. I am your guest host, Jennifer Juhas, filling in for David Pruse. And we have Rebecca Logan on the line with the Alliance, linking Alaska's resources to Alaska's people. And we really want to link natural gas to Fairbanks here. That's something that we really want to do. And we're talking about the different bill versions that are in the Alaska Senate and House right now, as well as DC's watchful eye on what we're doing here. And Rebecca, we talked about how there was a proposal from the governor for 10 years out on the volume being able to achieve revenue, and that the House version, House Bill 381 that's up today in House Resources, that we can listen to if folks aren't already tuned into this, many of our listeners are, but Gavel 360, Gavel Alaska, you can watch the legislative hearings online and see what's being discussed. You can watch them later because they archive these after the show, so to speak. You know, once the committee adjourns, takes about 20 minutes and it renders. But we've been waiting so long, more than 40 years for this gas line. And what are your thoughts on how fast, you know, Glenn Farn will have them on the air right after this for the second half of the hour, and they're talking about breaking ground soon. They have some agreements in place. We've waited for 40 years. Can we afford to wait a simple 2 years, do you think, that we'll be looking at achieving something with the gas line?
Well, I think if we have good legislation here that, you know, enables them to get to a final investment decision, we're going to see a lot of activity. I've got quite a few members who are actually working on different aspects of the project and putting numbers forward, you know, for getting for work to start on the project. So there's already quite a bit of activity that's happening. You know, they're spending about $115 to $150 million right now in the kind of the pre-feed, that, you know, before they get to final investment decision. And things could happen fast. You know, the momentum is there. You know, you talk about how long you've been waiting, and I've been at the Alliance for 16 years, and this is probably the fourth or fifth iteration, but I have never seen this kind of momentum, nor the geopolitical situation that we're in. And, I mean, it's just the stars are aligned, and so we have to, we could see some significant activity soon.
When you say activity, right. I hear jobs.
Yeah, well, that's what I hear, because I represent the people who have those jobs. Yes, a lot of jobs. I mean, they just, you know, the number of jobs at peak for that project, I think, you know, 4 years in, they anticipate they'll have somewhere around 7,000 jobs, you know, working on construction. And so it's just, it's absolutely incredible. But the difference that just 1,000 jobs or even a couple hundred jobs makes in this economy is so significant. So we feel that impact immediately when the activity starts.
And those are jobs for skilled workers. I mean, we're talking some of the desk jobs, right? Procurement, things mm-hmm. like that. But we're talking about moving dirt, laying pipe, welding pipe.
Yeah.
And we've talked with the trades. We had Amy Schumacher on here talking at the Alaska Joint Pipeline Training
yep.
Center about, you know, which phases would require which types of workers. But every time you say activity, I hear jobs in my head.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are, the skilled trades are what we should really be encouraging our young people to look at here, because those jobs will be there for years, and then the operational jobs will be another. We should really be encouraging our young people to look at those opportunities, because that is a very real opportunity, and not just for the net for AKLNG, which is the huge project, but for our very rapidly expanding oil industry here.
Well, and let's just talk about the gas line project itself, because we talk about this on this program sometimes too, with sport fishing industry. Let's make that connection. So there's the 7,000 jobs that would be related directly to this project, but with that means other jobs. With that is everything that's ancillary to that, you know, from retail and service
right.
to medical. You know, it's exponential what those jobs bring.
It sure is. You know, and you look at, so I mean, these are the highest paying jobs in the state, right? The average salary in 2024 for the industry was $181,000, and a significant numbers of those were jobs that didn't require a college degree. So that's very exciting, I think, for a lot of our young people. But yeah, when you start putting that kind of money into the economy through jobs and the people who live here and are spending that money here, it touches everybody. That's why we have such a diverse membership in the support industry. We have our, you know, our tier, what I call tier one contractors, who are providing direct support on a project. You know, your engineers, your rig hands, you know, your camps, things like that. But then you've got all the other, you've got the hotels who are putting people up. You've got, you know, like you said, you've got clothing stores, you've got restaurants. We have a whole bunch of companies like that who just see themselves as support to the industry, because all of that investment in the project and the jobs trickles down directly to them.
Well, and if we're going to capture those high-paying first-tier jobs, mm-hmm. that means, like you said, encouraging young people to go into apprenticeships. Now, those apprenticeships take time, and we've talked with the apprenticeship coordinators that we don't encourage someone to go into an apprenticeship that isn't going to yield a job when they get out. And so knowing that we actually have a gas line project is going to be key, because
yes.
we only need so many of each skill type in order to put them to work. We don't want someone to spend 2 to 4 years of their life going through an apprenticeship just to find out that, you know, a project didn't happen and they don't have work to go to. And that's when we talk about the train drain in addition to the brain drain, where then they're going to the lower 48 to do these things.
Absolutely. And when we lose people like that, when we don't have, you know, when we ramp up, and right now we're at, you know, pretty high capacity, I think, with our the oil projects, I should say, we have going on, and mining projects, and now we're going to layer AKLNG on top of that. And so we're going to need a lot of our people to be in those trades. But if, when, you know, something happens like the legislation that's pending now that introduces instability and then things stop, what happens with the support industry is people and equipment leave. And it's hard to get them back.
But you're saying that the House version is better, and we've tossed this around in Fairbanks and all over Alaska for a very long time, right? We are a resource state, and we are to be remunerated for the use of a resource. That's, you know, why we have things like the PFD.
Yep.
However, we know that we have to diversify our economy. We can't just wait for a project and then passively live off of it as well. And so we have to decide what's fair. Just like going back to buying a house, what is a fair interest rate? What is fair escrow? You know,
right.
Do I have to change the carpets? Do I need different permits? And you're saying that the current version in the House is closer to something that would be a reality.
I think so. Like I said, it's still a developing theme, but it's nowhere near as drastic. I mean, the Senate version, I think, I don't even know why anybody would consider even doing a project under what they put on there. The tax burden is so incredible that I just don't see how it could pencil out to be economic. I think the House is being much more thoughtful about that. I really do.
And it seems from some of the materials that are in that folder when I go to the legislative basis, a lot of our listeners do, to go find out what's going on, that some of the additional materials there show what's actually going to be recouped by the state and go to the people of the state, and that, you know, we aren't, as they say, giving it away.
Right. Right. And they, I mean, and again, those are projections based on the project happening. Right?
Well,
that's what you have to, I mean, you have to balance the whole thing, because if the project doesn't happen, you don't have revenue to allocate, you don't have energy relief for Alaskans, there is no economic boost, and it just ends up being another missed opportunity.
Well, Rebecca, I want to thank you for your time. I see on my little monitor here that we're going to go to a commercial break here real soon, but we will be following this, and for the second half of the hour, we will have Tim Fitzpatrick with Glenn Farn talking
Wonderful.
To us about the gas line, and I really appreciate your time this morning and explaining this to us. We know that you'll be watching things closely, and we'll be looking for reports from your group.
Great. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Hello? 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 Hello?
Good morning, Fairbanks. We are back on the air with Problem Corner. I'm Jennifer Uhas, your guest host, while David Pruse takes a break. And for the first half of the hour, we had Rebecca Logan with the Alliance talking about the gas line bills. For the second half of the hour, we have Tim Fitzpatrick. He is the communications director with Glenfarne Companies, who have the 8-Star Gas Line Project. Good morning, Tim. Can you hear us, Tim?
I can, Jen. Good morning. How are you?
Fantastic. We're glad that you could make time for us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, we had you present to the Chamber of Commerce last week, and we've been talking recently about some changes that we're seeing in the Alaska legislature. We spent the first half of the hour talking with Rebecca Logan about the practicality of what constraints we're putting on a gas line project, what we're hoping to gain from a gas line project, as well as the fact that D.C. is paying some very close attention to this with our national circumstances and international circumstances, and what that means for the project.
Well, I always like to start with just a little bit of a recap. And, you know, they say what's past is prologue, and I don't want to go too deep into the prologue, but I think it's important to start any conversation about Alaska LNG with the answer to the question, you know, why are we doing this? It's a big effort. It's an expensive effort. It's a complicated effort. Why are we doing this? And really the reason is, I mean, there's a massive amount of gas on the North Slope. It's one of the world's super basins. I mean, it's a very envious amount of accessible natural gas. It's already produced on a regular basis. I think the North Slope producers currently are producing enough natural gas for the nation of Germany, but it all gets reinjected because there's no infrastructure to get it to market. So Alaskans have been working for decades to figure out how can we use this energy for our own benefit and can we commercialize it and sell it for larger economic benefits for the state. So the prize is really too big to ignore, which is why you've seen effort after effort to get this gas to market and do something productive with it. And the current version of the project is called Alaska LNG. It was developed about 10 years ago by the North Slope producers. In 2014 or 15 or so, they stepped back from the project when the price of oil fell. The state took it over. I started working on the project in 2018 for AGDC, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, who carried it forward through permitting. And the state was very well suited for permitting the project because it's really a government-to-government type of exercise. But once permitting was completed, AGDC recognized that private sector expertise, funding, and know-how was going to be instrumental for making the project go forward. And when Governor Dunleavy was elected, he was very insistent. He said there's no way, shape, or form that the state should take on the risk or the complexity of this project. So that led to Glen Farne coming on board last year. And last year, I moved over from AGDC to begin working on Glen Farne. And I've been thrilled for the opportunity to continue working on the project because it's there's nothing else on the radar for Alaska that's got this type of impact and this type of transformational power for the state in terms of creating thousands of jobs, unleashing billions of dollars of added tax and royalty revenues for our states and our communities, and lowering the cost of energy, right? Alaska is an energy-rich state with some of the highest energy bills in the country. And if you can lower everybody's energy bills, whether you're a family, a small business, a school, or other, you know, military facility, that frees up a lot of money to save, to invest, to grow your business, to expand, to invent something new. So there's just this whole basket of benefits that Alaska will get uniquely from this project and unaccessible from other energy alternatives because you can't export wind, you can't export solar energy. So Alaska LNG is really kind of a unique project for Alaska. It's a big project like Alaska is, but Alaska's got such a small population, it would really be a very transformational project. So that's kind of the why, Jen, about, you know, why Alaskans have never given up on this and how Glen Farne got involved.
And those points that you hit are so close to home, especially after this harsh winter here in Fairbanks. We know that all Alaskans are hit with high energy costs, but we know that in Southeast they've got hydro. In Anchorage, it's a little bit less expensive than it is here. And nobody besides the North Slope and westward is really dealing with these prolonged 40 below winters. Local, yep, Fairbanksans, if we fill up that big oil tank, if we're not on another form of heat, usually in early fall, and then that's supposed to carry us usually to March, and then we've got to deal with something. But everyone was running out of oil in December, January this year because of the prolonged cold, and yep, we literally were going to drive through lines and trying to refill with jugs until sourdough fuel could come deliver for us, and there has to be a better way.
Right, that's right. Well, and that's a good question. I mean, why now for this project? And then the sort of the corollary to that is, if not this project, then what? And the why now is very interesting because history has shown Alaska to be a very strategically located source for energy, right? The Alaska pipeline came into being in the mid-70s with the Arab oil embargo. And I think we're at a very similar point in time now where Russia invaded Ukraine a couple years ago. That upset world energy markets. There's been closures in both the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal for a variety of military, geopolitical, and climate-related causes. So canal transit has gotten very difficult and unreliable for energy. You have conflict in the Middle East. I mean, 20% of the world's natural gas goes through the Straits of Hormuz, and that just got closed very unceremoniously and indefinitely. So Alaska's position as a short, direct shipping route to Asia really comes to the forefront in geopolitical events like this. At the same time, Cook Inlet's energy is becoming more expensive and less accessible. So
right,
you've got this sort of dual phenomena of, you know, world energy markets all of a sudden fleeing for safety and security, and Alaska realizing we need a better solution, right? Cook Inlet is no longer going to get us out of our energy insecurity problems. So you have the combination of in-state energy demand pulling the project forward, global energy demand pulling the project forward, and a new private sector developer pushing the project forward. So all those things combined really make this the moment for Alaska LNG. In the past year, Glenfarne has taken the project farther than it had ever gotten in the past 10 years in terms of the commercial, the breadth of the commercial work that's going on right now with North Slope gas producers, buyers in Asia, in-state natural gas users like NSTAR, Donlin Gold, pipeline contractors, line pipe suppliers, right? There's just this broad swath of commercial negotiations moving forward in parallel that the state's never seen for this project before. So we're not at a final investment decision yet. We need to line up all those things before we can get to a final investment decision. But we are moving forward, and we spend our days at Glenfarne figuring out how to make this happen and not spending any time asking ourselves if it's worth doing, because it's clearly worth doing. And we've made a promise to the governor, and we've made a promise to the people of Alaska to get this project done.
Well, we appreciate that. And we can't ignore those headlines, certainly. And you mentioned we're the closest we'd been in 10 years. And is it fair to say we're the closest we've been in 40 that we've been discussing this?
In history, no doubt about it. There's never been a North Slope gas project that has gotten as far as the Alaska LNG project has gotten. And one of the few remaining items that we're trying to work through right now is property tax reform, right? The state has a very rigid and high property tax structure that's been a known impediment for a North Slope gas project for more than a decade. If you go back and you look at legislation introduced over 10 years ago in Juneau, there were property tax reform bills that were put forward then. The borough mayors have all recognized that property taxes need to change. And if you look at, so 10 years ago, the U.S. was an LNG importer. The LNG industry, despite Alaska's long industry with it, is really a very nascent industry and has grown tremendously in the last 10 years. If you look at any other LNG project, really in the U.S. and across the world, there's a very specialized form of tax treatment that these projects get because they have very high upfront capital costs. The revenue streams associated with natural gas are much thinner than they are with oil, and it takes a long, long time to recover investment. So tax treatment for projects like this typically gives upfront relief so that projects can get up and running, clear their capital needs, start to generate revenue, and then pay back investors over a long period of time. So the timing of the taxes and the level of taxes is very consistent for LNG projects, but these projects are all so big that the tax treatment is often a customized tax treatment. So there's not really an off-the-shelf tax solution for LNG projects because they are all so big and so different and so unique.
So we've been looking at this volumetric reform instead of the property taxes. And so what was introduced by the governor had a 10 years. We're looking at a new bill that is in the House now that's looking at 6 years out. We likened this earlier on the program to just the common sense of, the layperson looking at buying a house that, we have to know what we're getting. We know the cost of the house, but then what's the interest rate and what's the escrow and what else do I need? What are the utilities? These seem like every analogy falls short, but it's just a way that we've been talking about it locally. Making, we're this close to the finish line and we don't want to be waiting another 40 years. So, looking at the stability of deciding to build this, we're paying attention. The White House is paying attention. And, we had a little wake-up call with this idea of federalizing things because it is so strategic and so important. And we talked about how that's a little bit of possibly them paying attention to what's happening in our Senate right now, trying to come up with something workable. We know that you've been talking to our local mayors. How do we move forward in the next few weeks? We're looking at a legislature that could adjourn and anybody who's purchasing anything, whether it's a car, a house, a gas line, when you're making that investment, you have to know what you're getting. Do you think that we can get there before the end of session?
Well, let me talk a little bit about sort of the rationale behind the policy approach that the governor introduced. So the existing property tax law in the books is it's a 20 mil rate, which is a percentage of the project's value. And the problem that TAPS has always had is there's been ongoing litigation for years and years and years, fights about, well, if you're going to value it as a percentage of what TAPS is worth, what is TAPS worth? And it's just, it's endless litigation, which doesn't do communities any good because their revenue picture is uncertain. It doesn't do the project any good, and it doesn't do the state any good. So what the governor did after speaking with borough mayors was introduce legislation that really tried to align project benefits with project outcomes. And he did so by putting a volumetric approach on taxation. So the taxes are linked to the amount of natural gas that flows through the pipeline. And what that does is it allows for greater revenue as project natural gas volumes increase for not only communities, but also project developers. So the more gas that goes through that pipeline, the more tax revenue is generated. So that's a win. The more volume that goes through that pipeline, the lower everybody's energy costs are, because Alaska is such a small state. It's a volume discount game. If you're just buying a little bit of natural gas, you're going to pay a high price. If you're able to move a lot of natural gas, the price per unit goes way down, like below anything the state has historically seen. So it's a win for consumers if it's a volume-based incentive, because then everybody's energy bills come down. So it's really something that helps with the state and communities, it helps consumers, and it helps the project developer. So now we're in the process of kind of negotiating the details of the legislation and what the impacts of that legislation will be. And you're seeing a couple different approaches. The governor's approach was a very straightforward piece of legislation that very directly linked tax revenues with pipeline volumes. The Senate Resources Committee has unfortunately taken a different approach, which would actually increase energy bills and quite possibly delay the project. And Alaska doesn't have any time to spare in terms of finding energy security. And the House Resources Committee, I think, has introduced a committee substitute that's somewhere in the middle. And I would ask anybody that's listening, there's a House Resources Committee hearing today at 1 o'clock. If you support this project, if you want to see your energy bill go down, if you want Alaska to have greater energy security, call into the House Resources Committee. They're taking public testimony today at 1 o'clock. And
many of our listeners are familiar with using the legislative basis. Some of you guys who aren't, you can simply Google Gavel 360 or Alaska Legislature Live. You'll find a website that'll take you to what is streaming at the time. And you can watch this right on your computer. You can That's keep doing what you're doing. If you're at home, you can keep doing your chores. If you're at work, you can keep doing your work. But you can have this on in the background on a little window on your computer. Just Gavel 360 or Gavel Alaska. Look for HB 381 and you can see what's happening, and there's a link to being able to give public testimony. You can even simply just send an email to our local legislators and elected officials to weigh in on your thoughts on this. And go ahead, Tim.
That's right. These legislators, they're all elected officials. They want to hear from voters. They want to hear from constituents, right? They want to know what the people of Alaska think. So they encourage public testimony. If you want to call and testify, the number in Fairbanks is 844-586-9085, and I'll repeat that. It's 844-586-9085. Call and, tell legislators you want to see your energy bill go down, you want to see your energy security go up, and you want Alaska LNG to deliver the benefits that Alaska's been waiting for decades from its North Slope natural gas.
If you're listening to us in your vehicle and you're going to be near downtown, you can go over to the Alaska USA Global building over there by Home Depot. And if you go up to the third floor, Carice, who runs the Legislative Information Office, she's got a room there. You can go testify. You can go watch the hearing right there, and you can testify if you're out and about. I know some of you do that. Randy Griffin, thank you for always giving your public testimony when you have the opportunity. That's one more way that people can weigh in and watch the discussion and get some materials. Some materials will be down there too.
Yeah, and there's a couple pretty key numbers associated with this legislation. I mean, right now, it's very easy to calculate the benefit Alaska is receiving from our North Slope natural gas because it's zero. Our state gets no taxes or royalties. Our communities get no taxes or royalties. Over the life of this project will deliver $26 billion in state tax and royalty revenue for the state government as well as for local governments. That's up from zero today. Those are numbers provided from the Department of Revenue based on the governor's version of property tax reform that was originally introduced. That doesn't apply to the Senate version. But there's some other key numbers associated with it. There'll be about $50 million a year deposited directly into a rural energy relief fund that is set up for communities that don't have access to natural gas from this project, because the state recognizes and Glenfarne recognizes that rural Alaska struggles more than anybody with high energy costs. So a portion of the royalty revenue from this project, to the tune of almost $50 million a year, will go into a very specialized fund to provide energy relief in our communities that won't have access to natural gas for this. So
well,
it's really,
that assists with the energy parity, but yeah. Fairbanksans also understand that as a hub community, we aren't deemed rural, but we have so many outlying rural areas, some of those municipalities, some of those villages, and we're a hub. People come here to go to the hospital. People come here for jobs.
Yep.
People come here for school. And the pressures that our rural counterparts experience, you know, so this will go towards alleviating that. This idea of what we gain if we build something and what's a zero sum if we have nothing. Fairbanksans are also used to that, guys. How many years did we go round and round with the Polaris building? First, it had to come down, and now it's being used as a community space. Some folks want to build something. Some folks think we've already built something in a community space, but we know we had nothing when we had that eyesore there, and this seems like it's our next project.
Yep, and I do want to talk about what's often referred to as the Fairbanks Lateral or the Fairbanks Spur, because I know that's a very important topic in the Fairbanks region, right? How can this project get built in a way that allows Fairbanks to have access to energy from this project? We've been working very closely with the Fairbanks and Interior Alaska delegation, as well as some private parties, to ensure that natural gas from this project will be available in Fairbanks. There's a little bit of history. I don't want to geek out too much on pipelines with people, but the Alaska LNG project has a gas treatment plant on the North Slope, an 800-mile pipeline, and an LNG plant, and it's all permitted as one integrated piece of infrastructure. A spur line to Fairbanks was not included in Alaska LNG's project, but it was included in the previous Alaska standalone pipeline project, which AGDC led through to completion of permitting. So there has, and that line, that project did include a lateral line to Fairbanks. So there has been a pipeline connecting Alaska LNG to the Fairbanks community that has been fully designed and fully permitted. So nobody that's involved with this project sees a Fairbanks lateral or a Fairbanks spur as a particularly difficult project. It should be relatively straightforward, easy to time with the completion of the Alaska LNG project, but it's outside the scope of our permits because we are permitted as one integrated project. But a spur line has been permitted, so there are a number of private entities that are interested in constructing the Fairbanks lateral that AGDC is working with, that Glenfarne is speaking with, because it just makes no sense for a project this big and this beneficial to get built without a Fairbanks energy solution. So the final answer hasn't been fully arrived at yet, but there are people working on it. There are people talking about it. And there's just, as the governor has said, there's just no conceivable way that Alaska LNG gets built without a Fairbanks energy solution.
And we appreciate that you're putting that out there one more time from the horse's mouth. That question comes up because it isn't part of the 8-star project, but that it has been permitted. And so that question gets tossed back and forth around a lot up here, saying, but it hasn't been permitted. It's not part of this particular permit, but it has been permitted and it's
correct.
Ready. And you are absolutely
correct.
Committed to working with those that will be developing that spur.
Yes, 100%.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for taking the time to explain a few of these things today. For our listeners, you can go to the LIO, you can go on Gavel Alaska, or you can dial in to the Alaska Legislature for the 1 p.m. bill hearing. And thank you for answering some of the questions that have been on our minds and taking the time to talk to us about how close we are to actually finally recognizing this project. You know, after a winter of months of 40 below, we're really feeling it up here and really anticipating the gas line, Tim.
Jen, always a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.